I'm going to begin this morning with a word from a great, credible source, and that is Sesame Street. In a classic skit, Ernie interrupts Bert because he wants to play the opposites game. And by the way, I'm not going to do the voices here. My kids always complained when I read to them that I didn't do voices. Not going to do them here, sorry about that, but you can find the sketch on YouTube. So Ernie wants to play the opposites game, which is where one of them says one thing and the other has to say the opposite. Now, Bert was very busy counting his paper clips when Ernie came in, and so Bert says, "No, Ernie, I don't want to play." And Ernie says, "Yes, Bert." Yes is the opposite of no. Well, Bert still isn't interested, and he explains why. He says, every time you have a game you want to play, I do not get to play it, because just about the time that I start to play, you stop. And Ernie says, go, Bert. Go is the opposite of stop. Bert says, no, I'm not playing. It always happens this way, always. Never, says Ernie. Bert is trying to stand his ground. He says, I am not playing. Just forget it. Remember, Bert. Remember is the opposite of forget. And he chuckles. And finally, Bert relents and he says, okay, I'll play. What is the opposite of play? And Ernie says, I can't think of the opposite of play, Bert. I'm stumped. I guess the game's over. So long, Bert. And Bert, you know, frowns as he does as he leaves. Well, I want to talk about opposites today. And very specifically, we've been in this series called When in Doubt. And we've been talking about faith and doubt. And I think we probably tend to think of those two concepts as like yes and no, like stop and go, like always and never. They're opposites. Now, maybe if you pay close attention to Jesus' words, you would think that, in fact, they are opposites. So we can go to Mark chapter 11 and we can find these words from Jesus. He says, have faith in God, Jesus answered. I tell you the truth, if anyone says to this mountain, go throw yourself into the sea and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will happen, it will be done for him. Therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask for in prayer, believe that you have received it and it will be yours. Now it sounds there like one or the other, doesn't it? You know, have faith in God, believe, and don't doubt, and you will get answers to your prayers. Maybe the implication that we would jump to is, if your prayers go unanswered, then maybe it's because you don't have enough faith. And that kind of response can heap on the guilt and the self-blame. But I want to suggest to you this morning that it's not that open and shut when we talk about matters of faith and doubt. In fact, I'm going to suggest to you a little later that faith has a different opposite than doubt. Here's the basic question I want us to think through this morning. What does it mean to have faith and doubt rather than faith or doubt? Maybe you've heard of the genius of the and. What does it mean to have both rather than one or the other? And I want to take you this morning to a story in the life of Jesus that illustrates this idea perfectly. So I'd invite you to join me, if you would, in Mark chapter 9, as we come upon a story of Jesus. Now, to put in context what we're about to read, Jesus and three of his disciples have just come from a literal mountaintop experience, commonly known as the Mount of Transfiguration, where Jesus suddenly appeared to these three disciples in his radiant divine glory. They've had this experience. They come down to find the other nine disciples. And this is what they find, beginning in verse 14. Follow along as I read. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. What are you arguing with them about? He asked. A man in the crowd answered, Teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. "You unbelieving generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has he been like this?" "From childhood," he answered. "It has often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." "If you can," said Jesus, "everything is possible for one who believes." Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the impure spirit. "You deaf and mute spirit," he said, "I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, "He's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. Now, there are many people in the scriptures that are commended for great faith. And in fact, Luke read for us this morning from Hebrews 11, kind of the Faith Hall of Fame, and he mentioned some of those names. This man, this father, would probably not show up in a passage like that. And in fact, he didn't. We don't know his name, but he didn't appear there. He doesn't seem like the type to have Olympic quality faith. But I want to invite you to put yourself in his shoes for a moment. His son has this spirit that makes him both deaf and mute. He's had it since childhood. I mean, maybe even since birth. Maybe this boy has never heard a sound. Maybe he's never spoken a word. And on top of that, he has these, what today we would think of as epileptic-like seizures occasionally that are so violent that it puts his life at risk. Now, can you imagine the dad's heartache through all of this? His heartache both just as he cares for his son and wants to love him as he is and yet desperately wants to do something that will change his condition, that will heal him, that will bring an end to his struggles. He's probably sought cures before. I mean, maybe he's gone to all kinds of people and places seeking some kind of relief from these challenges. You see the man's response in verse 22, as if he's had his hopes up before and they've been crushed. And so he wants to be careful this time. He says, "If you can do anything, if you can, would you take pity and would you help us?" He says to Jesus. Not words of ringing faith, or so it would seem. And then Jesus responds with words that sound on one hand encouraging and hopeful, but on the other hand, might be hard words for a man in these kinds of circumstances to hear. He says, "Everything is possible for him who believes." And if you're the man, how do you respond to that? I mean, do you get angry? Like, "I used to believe, I used to have strong faith, and that didn't get me anywhere. My son is still suffering." Do you fake it to try to get a positive response from Jesus? "Well, yes, I believe." He responds, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." Not mountain-moving confidence, not doubtless certainty, but an honest plea. And it must have been enough, because Jesus responds and he heals the boy. Now, what does that tell us about faith and doubt together? When we look at this story, when we look at this man's response, "I believe, help me overcome my unbelief," what does that tell us about the subject of faith and doubt, holding them together rather than one or the other? I want to suggest to you a few things today. Here's the first. It's simply this: we can't make ourselves believe when we don't. He says, "I believe, but help me overcome my unbelief." We can't make ourselves believe when we don't. Now, that's That idea is actually the subject of a funny passage from the story Alice in Wonderland. Some of you will remember the story, and in particular, the Red Queen, you know, kind of the outrageous, always shrieking Red Queen. Alice and the Queen have this exchange where the Queen says, "Now I'll give you something to really believe. I am 101 years, 5 months, and 1 day old." And Alice replies, "Well, I can't believe that." "Can't you?" asks the Queen in a pitying tone. "Well, try again. Take a deep breath and shut your eyes." And Alice laughs, and she says, "There's no use trying. One can't believe impossible things." And the Queen says, "I dare say you haven't had much practice. When I was your age, I always did it for a half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast." Can you make yourself believe impossible things? I think the dad would probably agree with Alice here. You can't make yourself believe. An English philosopher, Richard Swinburne, I think would agree as well. He said this. He said, "In general, a person cannot choose to believe there and then. Belief is something that happens to a person, not something he or she does." If we want to increase our faith, then just sheer willpower is not going to be enough. We can learn. I mean, we can study, we can pray, we can seek to know God better. And all of those things may lead us to grow in belief. But we can't make ourselves believe simply by trying or trying harder. We can't make ourselves believe things that we don't. But there is good news. And this is my second thought when we talk about holding faith and doubt together. And that's just the reality that we can be fully committed without being fully certain. You can be fully committed to something without being fully certain. Now, the dad, obviously, in our story, doesn't seem fully certain of anything. I mean, he's very tentative in his approach to Jesus, and yet, he was committed. And he must have been committed even just to get there, to get up when he hears Jesus is in town, to get up and to come and to bring his son. That took some commitment. And then he gets there and he realizes that Jesus himself is not actually there, that it's his disciples instead, which, you know, maybe a bit of a letdown if you're expecting to see the man himself. But even still, he approaches them. And then they fail, and then, you know, this kind of sideshow ensues with the teachers of the law there, and they're arguing back and forth. And again, if you're the dad, you might be tempted to just kind of like slip away into the crowd with your son, but he's still there. And Jesus comes. And still after all of this, he approaches Jesus and asks for help. He was fully committed even when he wasn't fully certain. Now, you might hear that and think that's good, but it doesn't seem to square with that quote that I read you from Mark 11 a few minutes ago when Jesus, you know, talks about mountain-moving faith. It'd be interesting to take a survey if we won't do that this morning, but how many people have actually, you know, put Jesus' words to the test and prayed that a mountain would move? He says, seems to say, if you believe it strongly enough and you don't doubt, then even something like that can happen. So how do you square this man's faith and doubt together and the idea that it's okay to hold them together? Well, consider the following statement Jesus makes after he talks about the mountain. He says, "Whatever you ask for, believe that you have received it and it's yours." Now, do we take that statement literally? I mean, does that mean, you know, Lord, I ask for a $10 million check to show up in my mail tomorrow? I mean, we would all say, might be nice, but That's not the way this works. And we would probably qualify Jesus' whatever statement there with, well, you know, it's about asking for things that would fit within God's will. You know, that's important. It's asking with the right motives, not just for selfish gain. You know, we would qualify Jesus' whatever. Well, maybe we also need to qualify the believe and don't doubt comment. John Piper suggests that, you know, when we understand Jesus' statement, what we can understand him to mean is that we can have certain confidence if there is an absolute promise about what it is that we're asking. So, for example, if I ask God to save me from my sins, then I can have strong confidence that he will do it because he's promised that anyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. If I ask God to help me to be faithful through a tough situation, to help me be faithful to him, I can trust that he will, because he's promised to give me everything that I need for godliness in my life. If I ask him to take this particular situation and over time work it out for good, I can have confidence that he will do that because he promises to. But in a specific situation, I don't necessarily know how that's going to turn out. You know, when I bring a very specific need to God for like healing, like the man in the story, or you know, maybe one of my prayers once in a while is to help me find something that I've lost, you know. With those kinds of prayers, God may or may not give us the answer that we're looking for. We don't know what he's going to do, so we can't pray with doubtless faith in those situations, Piper would say. Sometimes we have to pray, not my will, but your will be done, because we don't know his will. The point is that having faith does not rule out all doubt in most situations. Like the man in Mark 9, many times we can both believe and struggle with unbelief at the same time. But here's the thing. Our level of commitment does not need to change based on the amount of confidence that we feel. In fact, we have to make commitments sometimes without certainty. I mean, we do that in marriage. We do that in friendship. We do that in our job. And yet we find it difficult to do in our spirituality. And yet I would argue that our spirituality is no different from these other areas of our lives in that regard. When it comes to our spiritual connection with God and our eternal destiny in relationship with him. John Ortberg says this. He says, my brain cannot provide the certainty that I'm betting my life on the truth. My mortality will not provide the luxury of waiting until I know for sure. There is one road to certainty through a door marked death. Then I will know, or there will be no me left to know, but I need to decide now how I will live on this side of that door. If we can live that way, if we can have commitment without certainty in so many other areas of our lives, why not in our relationship with God? We can hold the two together, faith and doubt, uncertainty and commitment. I hope hearing that word is helpful to you. If you find yourself struggling with, you know, feeling guilt when you have doubts, or you're uncertain about why prayers go unanswered, you can still be fully committed even with the doubt. Third suggestion for you, what does it mean to have faith and doubt together? I'd suggest to you it means trusting Jesus just enough to act. It means trusting him enough to act when we hold these two together. Now, there are three biblical words that we typically associate with faith. So sometimes we'll talk about the word faith itself. Jesus did in the verses that I read earlier, have faith, Jesus says. And I think when we talk about the word faith, we tend to think of, you know, how I feel about something. Do I feel confident? Do I feel hopeful? And we'll tend to associate faith with kind of banishing negative thoughts or fears or doubts. That's faith. That's one word we use when we're talking about this whole idea. Another word we use sometimes is believe. We talk about believing something. And I think when we talk about believe, we tend to think about intellectual ideas that we agree with. So, you know, God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son that whoever believes in him shall not perish. You know, we believe in our head. It's something we think is true. And then the third word that we use in this kind of family is the word trust. And trust we tend to talk about in relationship to a person. And when we talk about trusting a person, the implication is that it leads to some kind of action. So, you know, if you trust your 17-year-old driver, you let them get behind the wheel of the family car sometimes. Trust leads to action. Here's the interesting thing. We talk about faith. We talk about belief. We talk about trust. And we sometimes, I think we tend to think of kind of three slightly different things. You know, in our translation of the scriptures, faith, belief, trust all come from essentially the same word in Hebrew and Greek. We make them three different words. They're really one word in the original language. There's no distinction between them. I like this definition of faith. This comes from a pastor named Bruxy Cavey. He says, faith is the belief or trust in a person that moves us to act lovingly and loyally toward that person. Now, if we take this definition seriously, then of those three words that I talked about, faith, belief, trust, it's really trust that is the prominent one of the three. Faith is not primarily an intellectual or a doctrinal or a feelings kind of word. It's about a relationship. A relationship that leads to action. And thus, faith springs out of a relationship with God. And it involves acting in trust. And we need both halves of that. If we're going to have faith, then we need both, you know, the trust that comes in the relationship, and we need the action that goes with it. Because when you trust, what happens? Sometimes you take a risk. If you trust someone, sometimes you take a risk. You know, I go to a restaurant that you recommend because I trust you. The trust leads to an action. I read a book because you tell me that it's good. I tell you something personal and trust that you won't share it with other people, that you'll keep it in confidence. I invite you to be a partner in a business deal, or I invite you to be my friend, and then I see if you're faithful. I take part of myself, whether it's my time or my money or my possessions or my heart. I take part of myself and I put it in your hands. And in that moment, I make myself vulnerable. And then I find out if you are dependable. I give you the gift of my trust. You give me, in response, the gift of your faithfulness. And over time, a relationship grows. And this is the kind of relationship that God invites us into. Not one where all uncertainty is erased, but one where, like the Mark 9 dad, we come with our basket of faith and doubts together. We come and we take a risk and we see what God does. But it's not a blind risk. I mean, we've got a written record of God's faithfulness over thousands of years. And he's got a pretty decent track record if you believe what the scriptures tell us. Plus, we've got stories of faithfulness in the present from other people. Many of you, if we were to have, you know, a good old-fashioned testimony meeting, some of you will remember those. If we were to have that, many of you could and maybe would stand up and testify to God's faithfulness. Times in your life where you trusted him and you saw that trust rewarded. So yes, we have to take a risk sometimes on God because we don't have certainty. But when we consider the evidence, there is reason for hope and reason even for trust. And then also what happens over time is God gets stories of faithfulness from us, of our faithfulness to him. Times and situations when we doubted, but we still acted in trust, and he is honored by that. And those stories of faithfulness, they build a relationship with him over the years. And I would just make the case that having a trusting relationship is better than having certainty. I mean, certainty, to have certainty, that requires absolute control. That requires predictability. And yeah, some of us really like those things. But trust, that involves growth. That involves intimacy. That involves surprises. And sometimes they're unpleasant for sure, but sometimes they're wonderful, encouraging surprises. At the beginning of the sermon, I said faith and doubt are not opposites. But I said I think faith does have an opposite, and this doesn't come from me. This is another church father from centuries ago. He suggests that the opposite of faith is actually pride. It's when we're arrogant, when we are self-reliant rather than God-dependent, when we live as if everything depends on us and what we do, when we shut God out so we can live on our own terms. That's the opposite of a trusting relationship with him. That's the opposite of faith. And I just want to end here with this last observation. Our lives really tell the story of whether we trusted Jesus or not. I mean, at the end of our lives, however long they are, that's, you know, it's looking back that you'll see that your life will tell whether you trusted him or not. We are never going to have complete knowledge in this life or proof before we make a decision, but sometime we need to decide if we are going to trust Jesus or not. And not making a decision is not an option. Because, I mean, not making a decision and holding off is making a decision. I mean, we've got to live our lives. And in our lives, we can either pray or not. We can either worship God or not. In a sense, what happens is our lives will become the voting booth of sorts, where we cast our vote whether we believe that there is a God or not. And there will only be certainty after we die, and by then the choice will be made. When I was in high school, my family would often, for a week or so over the summer, go to Raystown Lake in the western part of the state. Some of you probably know that. We'd pack up our little pop-up camper, and we'd go and spend several days there. Some families from the church that I grew up in would go at the same time, so we'd have, you know, time there with friends. One year, some friends of mine went out from our camping area to a small cliff. Small cliff, I mean, you know, 50 feet, I don't know, not a super huge kind of cliff. And out on that cliff, my friends jumped into the lake. And it was an exhilarating leap for them. I didn't jump. I'm not a big fan of heights. And however high it was, especially at the top looking down, was a little too high for me. And so I just couldn't steel myself to do it. Everyone else in the group did it, and I wasn't doing it. But I felt this kind of pressure to experience what they were experiencing, FOMO here, fear of missing out. So eventually they all left and went on to do other things, and I was still there standing at the cliff by myself, looking over the edge, trying to muster up the courage to jump. And, you know, thinking about the situation and trying to talk myself through it, and I couldn't talk myself into it, but I finally just did it. I mean, I had seen them all do it. They were fine. And so I finally just did it. I jumped. And what a feeling. I only did it once, but it was a good feeling that one time. We all have to make a leap of faith. We all do. Whatever we believe, there are certain things in life we will never know with certainty, and we have to make a leap of faith. Now, that doesn't have to mean that we believe impossible things for no good reason. It does mean that we weigh the evidence, but then we have to make a commitment, even amidst uncertainties. We all make a leap, but we can choose to whom we jump. So I invite you to come and jump to Jesus, doubts and all. Come with your questions and your fears and uncertainties, and just because you have them doesn't mean you can't come. He wants to be in relationship with every one of us. And so whether you're coming for the first time or you're coming back again after a while, or you're coming just as you frequently do, come in faith and doubt, yet still with commitment. And let your story, the story of your life going forward, be the one that you'll look back on someday. And the story that your life tells is one of trusting the God who caught you when you jumped. Would you pray with me? If you've never made that leap of faith to Jesus before, maybe in this moment you would want to do that. Just by saying to him, Jesus, you know my doubts, but I want to believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. Help me trust you. And live a life that looks different because I have. Jesus, may we all be willing to come to you not as people who have everything figured out, not as people full of self-righteous certainty, but as people who are committed. Committed to walking with you, to going through this life with you, to being faithful and looking for your faithfulness. Amen.